Welcome to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. I'm Daniela, and this podcast is about my personal and also about a lot of other people's enthusiasm for art. Art can touch on all parts of life, and therefore we talk about all parts of life. I hope to get you on board and to tell you interesting stories you enjoy listening to. For our international listeners, the podcast will be held mostly in English. We're recording via the internet, so please excuse any glitches and sound quality. Episode 67, recorded September 5, 2022. My guest today is Dr. Magnus Resch, professor at Yale University and one of the world's leading art market economists. Magnus is passionate about the economics of the art market. He studied at Harvard, the London School of Economics, and the University of St. Gallen, holds a PhD in economics, and was awarded scholarships by both the Konrad Adenauer Foundation and the Swiss National Foundation. He's also a best-selling book author and serial entrepreneur, and has written 7 books on the art market, including 3 bestsellers. Hi, Magnus. A great pleasure to have you. I'm really excited.
Hi, Daniela. Thank you for having me on your podcast. Super excited to be here. So many of my friends were on the podcast, so I'm very honored that you finally asked me to.
Oh, thank you so much. That's very kind. There's a lot of things published about you. You've already been guests on several podcasts, so there's a lot of information on what you're doing. You wrote a few books. You are an expert on NFTs and the blockchain now. There's been already quite a lot published, the platforms you founded, your career, and so on and so on. And you're even considered to be a kind of art business influencer. And I would like to talk a little bit also about the love for art, the things art can provide that are priceless. But as always, I'm starting where it started. So go back to the roots. And for you, that was Düsseldorf, my town, famous for its Kunstakademie, its artisans, institutions, and how did art enter your life there?
Different to a lot of people in the art world, I'm not coming from one of these wealthy art collector families. I didn't grow up around art, and my family certainly doesn't own a private museum, nor did they have any relations to galleries and so on. Mm-hmm. So this whole concept of what is a gallery, what's an auction, what's the role of museums, artists, everything was very new to me. I got involved in the art space. I bought my first artwork when I was 17 in Düsseldorf at Dr. Andreas Sturius auction.
Mm-hmm. And why did you do that?
I happened to pass by with my father, and back then they were holding these auctions. Dr. Sturius was holding these auctions in very small rooms. Mm-hmm. I think later on he switched to much larger rooms. But back then we literally just walked in and I saw this edition that I liked, and then we purchased it.
So it was really because you just wanted to own it because you liked it?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And because it was affordable. So I thought, hey, that's cool. Having an artwork for, that was still Deutsche Mark. So I think I paid maybe 400 marks for it.
Which is a lot of money for a 17-year-old.
Yeah, obviously I got a credit from my
father. From your dad, but,
yeah. And then I had to pay him back eventually. And that was Ruprecht Geiger, for those who know him.
That's real art.
Yeah, serious art. And a small edition, and still today, one of my favorite artists. What I really liked about his art is, obviously it's very approachable. Mm-hmm. It's not complicated, right? Ruprecht Geiger, for those who don't know him, they should definitely look him up, works a lot with colors. So it's very plain, very colorful, abstract. Think of Alex Israel, but without any figures in it. I really liked it. And what I particularly liked about him is that back then he was already very old. I think mm-hmm. he died when he was 101 years old. And when I purchased from him, he was around 80. So I thought that's cool. That's special. This guy clearly knows what's going on. He's been doing it for a long time.
Oh, that's interesting. So that was your first encounter with art, and you directly bought something?
Yeah, that was really the first real encounter. Of course, I'd been forced to go to museums when I was younger.
You've been forced, okay. By your parents or by school?
School, parents, you know, on a rainy Sunday when you can't play soccer or tennis, mm-hmm. That's what your parents do with you, right? So I went to a couple of museums, but that was really the first time that I purchased something. And then the journey continued. I went to school in England, but also in Düsseldorf. And my school happened to be right next to the famous art academy in Düsseldorf, Kunstakademie Düsseldorf.
So that was the Ursulinen-Gymnasium.
Exactly. One of the oldest schools in Düsseldorf, run by the former, by the nuns and the monks and so on, a Catholic school. And that happened to be next to the art academy. And in our free time, when we didn't have school or when we wanted to skip classes, we met on Ratinger Straße.
Yes.
That street is known to be the birthplace of not only punk rock in Germany, but also a nucleus. So Joseph Beuys was hanging out there. Gerd Richter was having drinks there. So all the old school guys from the art academy, they went on that street. And that's where I ran into a couple of artists who later became friends of mine. They were in the first year at the art academy. And that's how I really got involved in the contemporary art scene and in the young emerging art scene.
So you met the artists, actually, the students.
Yeah, it was all coming really through personal contacts. That was, I remember it very well. Chris Zuko, who is still one of my closest friends today and whose work I'm still collecting today. He was probably the first professional artist who I ever had a longer conversation with. And he introduced me to his friends. So Henning Strasburger, Pepi Bottrop, David Ostrowski, Michael Pegelis, Max Frintrop. All these guys that have become incredibly successful. I mean, David Ostrowski, Michael Pegelis, they're with Spritmagers. Chris is with Armin Rech and The Journal. Pepi Bottrop is with Zies Höcke, is having a show right now. I just got his price list. Max Frintrop. So these are the guys. I still love all of their art. I'm a big fan and follow and so happy of their successes.
Which is really interesting because artists have a certain view on art because they are the creators. You couldn't have been closer. How did you then decide to go into economy? So it was from the beginning on that you wanted to go on the business side of things?
Not really. I mean, these were friends. So we were hanging out. We went to parties together. I visited them in their studios. You know, it was just a circle, a social circle, really. And here and there, I bought a small piece, which I could afford.
Yeah.
Now, at some point, I went to the army, and then I went to New York to do an internship after the army. And while I was doing the internship, I went to the Strand. The Strand is the biggest bookshop in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And there I found a book which had the original signature of the author in it. The book was called I Sold Andy Warhol by Richard Polsky.
Yeah.
And I only bought it because I thought, hey, there's the signature of the author in it, so I can probably sell it for much more on eBay. Not knowing that Richard Polsky is probably not as famous, so people wouldn't spend that money, extra money on a book. But that was my thinking. So I bought it in the downstairs area of the Strand where secondary books are being sold.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously nobody wanted to buy that book. So I started reading. And that was my first touch point with the business side of the art world.
But you studied economy and business. And so that is where inside of you, you started merging those things where you thought like, yeah, I can add something new to that field.
Yeah, I then pursued my studies in Switzerland and in the US. Costs for studying were pretty high. So I was thinking about ways how to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And given that I knew some artists, I knew their struggles to sell, to make money. So I had the supply. And my brother, he is 3 years older and he started a career as investment banker in London. So when these guys got their first bonus, I realized, hey, there's an opportunity to actually sell them art at a very affordable price. So I remember very well that I was traveling with some of these artworks in my suitcase or by car to the UK and hanging works by my artist friends in my brother's friend's small investment banker offices or flats. And that's how it all started. And that's really for the next 3 to 5 years, I was selling art from young and contemporary artists.
But that was really the spirit of really also supporting those artists.
Yeah, because from all my conversations that I had with my friends, I realized that they are struggling. They don't have enough money. Nobody's buying their work. When you're a student in your first or second year at an art academy, it's just hard. It really is. And at the same time, I liked their work a lot. I liked them on a personal level. And I thought price points were affordable.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought my first Krasuko piece for less than $1,000, which is now worth much more, the larger ones. And I was selling other works by these guys who are now selling for $60,000 to $100,000 at a fraction of that, which still today, every time I hang out with my brother's friends, they still applaud me for that because they benefited from the price increase. None of them has ever sold anything because they like it. And for them, it was also the first artwork that they bought. So there's a personal connection to it too. But they are obviously happy that now what they paid for 20 years ago is now worth much more.
Yeah, but there's also where this interesting double-sided discussion comes in about the investment, art as an investment, you know. I mean, you even stated in a podcast that art very often is a bad investment, and that you kind of like strive to open up people for buying art also for other reasons, to support the community, to support art as a cultural value, which is probably priceless, you know. I mean, what art can offer to your life is a priceless thing. And I often find that the discussion about purely the monetary investment is a very dead discussion because it does not value the other factors art can provide to your life. So how do you deal with that? Because frankly, I only knew you before in kind of like that investment and business discussion.
Yes. I have a very clear statement on that. And that is, art is a very bad investment. Now, we don't have an open discussion about this. It's so interesting that gallerists, artists, nobody really talks about this so openly. The truth is, and I wrote my PhD on this and did multiple studies on this, spent really a lot of time looking at the data, art is a bad investment. However, yes, it is a good investment if you go at the top end of the market. Here we're talking about the Jeff Koons, Damien Hirst, Warhol, Basquiat. Yes, those artists are a good investment. And yes, those artists outperform any stock index, S&P 500 and so on. When you look at these graphs, the Mayan Moses index that was bought, funnily enough, by Sotheby's and all these other indexes that always show that art is a great investment, they all have one major error, and that is they only input data from artworks that have repeatedly been sold at auctions. Now, everyone in the art world, every professional knows, in order for an artwork to make it into an auction, it needs to sell in the primary market, first of all, which is very unlikely that an artwork actually gets sold in the primary market. And secondly, it needs to be resold again in an auction. And then, in order to make it into these indexes, it needs to be sold again in an auction. So by just listening to what I said, you hear how difficult it is to actually get into these indexes. Basically, they look at the top most traded artworks. And yes, surprise, surprise, these outperform any other index. It is like if you would look at the S&P 500 or the DAX, any stock index, and just choose the best and most traded items and then create an index out of this. Well, to nobody's surprise, obviously, these outperform everyone else. And that's what these indexes do. If you look at the sheer amount of all the artworks that are being on sale right now in galleries and auctions, one clear statement, none of them are a good investment unless you buy one of the top 20 artists, which make up, by the way, 50% of the total value of the overall market. So don't invest in art.
Yeah, or if you're lucky and you buy, by luck, so early, one of the artists, as you just said, so cheap that they more than 10 times make the value in 10 years or in 5 years or in 2 years, you can be lucky and buy one of those who later becomes a Jeff Koons. But that is, again, the monetary investment discussion. So listening to you then, you would say then not buy art? No, that's not what you say.
No, I say buy art. But Daniela, yes, and I mentioned that before, those artists that I sold to them, they increased in price. But hey, it's like the lottery. I only mentioned those that went up in price. But hey, I sold a lot of artists back then that didn't go up in price and where there's no secondary market. So we're always biased, right? Even I find myself biased. I talk about my successes more than I talk about my losses. And there were as many artists that I sold that didn't go up in price. Luckily, those guys, and mostly guys really, that I hang out initially in my career, they turned out to be very successful because they were also part of the right network. But we talk about this in a second. What I recommend to all my friends, to everyone who's asking me, oh, Magnus, what should I buy? You're the art expert. What should I buy? I always tell them, very simple, buy what you like, because most likely you won't see the money again of what you're buying. So I explain to them the concept, which I find much more relevant and powerful. Art gives you way more than an increase in prices and is way more than a financial asset. Art gives you an emotional pleasure just by looking at it. It fills a necessity, which is it fills the white space above your sofa. So it is aesthetically pleasing. And thirdly, you can flex among your friends that you bought an artwork. So it gives you social credibility. It gives you access to a whole new industry. And fourthly, it has a big philanthropic aspect, which is when you buy art, you're supporting an artist. So the artist can continue creating what she is doing. And you're also supporting an entire community because every artist has a lot of art friends. And if they see that this artist succeeds, then they will continue doing what they're doing, which supports them. And those four criteria far overweight all the financial aspect and gains that you might explore if you're very lucky.
So what is for you the importance of art and art making then? Because I think it is something that, you know, now tells the story of our human existence from the beginning. And therefore, I think, you know, even if you pay now $25,000 and you can afford it, you know, in 10 or 20 years, it doesn't matter which price you paid, even if it was not a monetary investment, it was an investment in your life, don't you think?
You know, that's always highly subjective. I mentioned the motives why people, what I recommend all my friends, and all of these motives that I mentioned, I find myself having when I purchase art. Just recently, I purchased an artist, Ruben Benjamin, and I purchased him, his work, because he flew to New York. He's a German guy. He flew to New York to meet me and tell me about his career and ask me for his advice. So clearly this guy has drive. Clearly he understood how relevant it is to expand the network and how relevant it is to look beyond the local circle that you are in. He started as an artist, self-taught. He studied mechanical engineering in Munich. Finished it and didn't want to pursue a career at Siemens or one of the large German corporates, BMW or whatever, but pursued his dream to becoming an artist, which I loved. I really liked the guy and immediately purchased something, Ruben Benjamin, and I'm super happy to have it. So here, my motive was supporting an artist and supporting the community around him. Now, I have other motives too. Sometimes I buy because I walk into a gallery and I see something and I absolutely love it. Anna Vogel is one of these examples. Mm-hmm. I saw her work at an art fair. She's now represented by, I think, Sperling in Munich is representing her. And I saw their work at Fries in New York. Immediately loved it. No, Sprut Magers, I saw it, I think. But Sperling is representing her. Anna Vogel, great artist.
Yeah, Konrads used to represent her, I think, in Düsseldorf.
Yeah, exactly. So she's been through only great galleries, and I'm surprised that Van Horn hasn't shown her because Van Horn is also having a great program. So
thank you.
I love the artist, and I immediately bought it simply because I found it aesthetically pleasing. So as you can see, I'm super spontaneous, and that's what people should do. Don't care so much about the investment aspect. Just buy what you like. And my advice is also to buy in the price range that is affordable to you.
Yes.
In the sense that, hey, whatever you buy today might be worth nothing tomorrow. So if you can't afford buying something for 10K, don't do it. Buy something for less. And
yeah,
there's
absolutely
a lot of art out there that is affordable at a lower price point. I started with 400 Deutsche Mark.
Yeah. So that was something I was really curious about, you know, what your initial drive is. How do you see then, because you're always talking a lot about the intransparency of the art market and the intransparency of the galleries that are involved. So how do you see the role of gallery in there? How should they ideally deal with the things?
So the art world has a huge problem, and that is it's in a recession. The number of buyers, it's going down year after year. Why the art market remains stable in terms of overall turnover, which is, by the way, still very small. So the overall turnover of the entire art market, that means all the galleries, all the auction houses, all the art advisors, everyone combined, is around $60 billion. Now, that has been at this level for the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because prices at the very top end of the market have increased. Read the news. You constantly hear about new record prices. It is because a few artists at the very top take up all the attention and make all the revenue. So their prices increase while everyone else is struggling. Now, the number of buyers at this lower end segment is going down. And why is that? Because the art market has made it incredibly difficult for people to buy art. I believe that when we increase transparency, and hereby I talk primarily about price transparency, mm-hmm. more people will buy art. I give you a very simple example. If I go into a gallery, and I've been to thousands of galleries in my almost 20 years experience in the art world, I'm still intimidated. And every time I walk into a gallery, I'm intimidated. There are these big doors that I need to open. There's some gallerina looking at me. And then I go up to an artwork. Of course, I don't know who the artist is, because how would I? There's so many artists mm-hmm. out there. I have no idea what the price point is. So then I have to go up to the front desk, hey, and inquire, hey, can I, what's the price? And then usually they answer, I don't know. It's in the range between 10,000 and 1 million. I was like, all right, thank you, 10,000 and 1 million. What's the price of this?
Is that really the case? Because, for example, we have price lists openly on the desk.
Well, that's why you're successful.
Thank you, Magnus. And also, I think during Corona, all these, you know, these viewing rooms came into existence where actually there are prices, you know, so people can really look the prices up. And don't you think it's changing right now? Although on the other hand, I think you're really right, because I feel very often that why don't you all run into the galleries? Because if you're interested in art, even if you don't buy, you can see cutting edge art for free. You don't even have to pay an entrance fee.
Exactly.
And people are not coming, you know? So there is a storytelling of intimidation, which I think, at least in Germany, it's not true anymore. I mean, we try to be open houses. I think so, yeah.
They try to. However, what galleries have done wrong in the past 30 years cannot be washed away in 5 years. This whole idea of elitism, exclusiveness, which was one of the marketing tricks that galleries attempted to play for years, has failed.
And it worked. It worked.
And it worked. But it has failed to this new generation. Our generation is used to get all the information immediately without any of this elitist VIP bullshit that some galleries are still practicing. I mean, it's ridiculous that prices are not being transparent in so many galleries. How can a gallery put up a website and not show the prices? Artsy has done research on that. An artwork is four times more likely to sell if the price is visible next to it online. Four times. Every e-commerce person who's listening right now, or everyone who runs an e-commerce store, they would die to see an increase of four times conversion by changing this one simple thing, just adding the price. So I recommend all the artists that I coach in my online classes and in my books, I tell them, wherever you post an artwork, always put the price next to it.
But you know that there are artists that don't want that, actually, that say, please don't post the price.
Yeah, but why? Because it's old school. because they've been practicing it forever. I hear these comments all the time, artists who are really just entering the market, but the one thing that they know is not to post the price because galleries might not like that, or other artists might know what my prices are and might laugh at me or whatever. It's so wrong. It's so wrong. And I've been fighting this forever. I've been in trouble so many times. I got banned so many times from galleries because I've been so vocal about this. Hey, the law in New York is that you need to put up the price next to your artwork. So those galleries who are not doing it are actually not according to the law. And on top of this, hey, if you want to sell, here's a very simple argument, and that is 4x increase in conversion. What else can I tell you that you put up the prices?
Mm-hmm. Magnus?
Yeah.
What else can you tell me?
That was more a rhetorical
question. Oh, that was more a rhetorical question. Because, oh, yeah, tell me. Hey, I really would like to know.
No, that was a rhetorical question. Sorry that it didn't come through.
Yeah, well, that's the audio format, but I understand. So in one of the podcasts you just did, there was also Amy Capolazzo, who said something which I found beautiful and true. She said that something like that the art market is like really sexy, desirable, but also unregulated market, which is probably true, but it also has a certain allure, I think, you know, because art is also something which you can't just pin down to economics, or you can say like a successful artist can be somebody who produces for market to please a certain audience. But is that really the role of an artist? Or is the role of an artist probably to create something super unexpected, which in the beginning the mainstream might not like, and which unfortunately in the beginning might be not so successful, but is really meaningful?
Well, we need to differentiate between two key segments of the market. What Amy is saying there, and her partner Adam was just in my class that I taught last week at Yale, they look at the art market from the top end of the market, and that is totally okay. They're dealing in super expensive, high-end element of the market where art is really an asset. And at this type of art and with this customer group, yes, it makes sense to create this whole elitism and exclusive allure around it. Totally agree. Those people who trade in that segment, for them, it's a working marketing technique. They're really trading luxury asset that is desirable. However, they're targeting an audience of 3,000 people. Now, what I often see is that young galleries are going after the same 3,000 people and trying to imitate that exclusiveness. Obviously, that's not going to work. Amy and Adam and Alan, they're going to invite their clients to better restaurants. They're going to host the better parties. They have the better inventory. Now, dear young gallery, you're not be able to compete with that. So don't go after these clients. What you want to do is you want to nurture your new clients, those people who are first-time buyers, because they are by far in the majority when it comes to potential customers. Now, analyzing this customer group is what is key in order to be successful. And Daniela, you've done a great job in that, because from all your clients, when you look at this, how many of those would you count to be the top art buyers in the world?
Right.
So most of your clients are people that you nurtured, that you introduced to the art world, that you introduced to artists, and you gave them the whole conversation and the talk, and you showed them what the art world is really about. And that's why you are successful, because you managed to create your own customer base. And that is what artists have to do. We are working in an industry where the existing customer base is not interested in buying new stuff, in buying emerging artists. These people are interested in buying assets.
No, we need to have new people all the time.
Exactly. Everything that we do, everything the art world has to do in order to survive, is to focus on the first-time buyers, those people who are so far left outside of the art world, who are interested but don't know where to start. These people have three questions. First question, what should I buy? Second question, how much is it? Third question, is it a good investment? First question, tell them what you have. Explain them why you chose that. Second question, show up the prices. And third question, explain them that most likely it is not a good investment. However, there are so many other things that you can gain from that. And I mentioned those motives before.
That's actually the conversations I have. That is, there's so much very practical information in that. Also, you said you also do a course for artists. So for you, should the artist be kind of like an entrepreneur, self-management, because that might not be working for all artists. And also it takes away time and also a certain mental space, which is very different in entrepreneurship and creating art.
Yeah.
So what would your advice on that? Probably galleries are needed.
I'm a big fan of galleries. I was often misunderstood, and often it was my case because I was being too provocative with some of my statements. I'm a big fan of galleries, and galleries need to be there because they filter the oversupply of artists that we have and curate them in a form that makes them accessible to new buyers. So the work that you are doing, no artist could end up in a museum without the support of galleries. Galleries are, there's never been a time when we were able to see so much art for free. And why is that? Because all the galleries are doing that job. And they don't even get paid for that, right? I can walk around Düsseldorf or wherever, New York. In New York, there are 1,500 galleries that are open almost every day showing new contemporary art. It's unbelievable. There's never been a time like that. And look at all the shows that you're putting up, the effort that you put in your work to create shows. It's unbelievable what galleries are doing. Now, artists, on the other hand, cannot rely entirely on galleries for their success. So I've been saying for a long time that artists need to be entrepreneurs. Think of it as an app developer, someone who builds mobile apps. So these people are often developers, right? I would call them artists too, because their mindset is very similar. It's focused on the one thing, on creating something. They can spend hours in their room just to build a mobile app. Now, when they create that app, they launch it in the app store. And then what? Nothing happens. Similar to an artist, they're in the studios, they create artworks, and then what? Nothing happens. So the app developer needs to go out, market the app, make networks, make partnerships, reach out to potential clients, talk to the press, and so on to market it. Now, the artist has to do the same thing. Just relying on the app store, which is the gallery, to do the job for them does not work. Especially when you look at the fact that most galleries represent roughly 20 artists. And at the same time, they're single owner operator companies with maybe one or two employees, often interns. So how can these one and a half, two people manage the career of 20 artists? As an artist, you cannot rely on them simply because galleries cannot handle all of this. So my recommendation to artists is, and that's really what I try, that's why I built my class on magnusclass.com, where I have a class for artists to explain them how to navigate the art market and become successful and sell more works. And the other class that I have is for collectors, where I explain them how the art market works, how they can identify artists to invest in, but also what the insights of the art market are. Why I'm doing these classes is, particularly what the one for artists, is to explain them what they don't learn at art school, which is the whole marketing skills that nobody ever taught them. How to price your work, how to write an artist statement, how to create your website, and these things.
Actually, I think it is the duty of art schools to provide courses like that. I even offered the Kunstakademie many years ago to, you know, just like, let me give a lecture just to explain what a gallery is, what happens after the Kunstakademie.
And?
Yeah, no, nothing.
It's so funny that you say this, Daniela. I did the same thing. I wrote them emails, and at some point I visited Düsseldorf. I sneaked into the office of the main guy there and put a handwritten letter on his desk. And they never reached out. I offered them to teach for free at Kunstakademie Düsseldorf. So if they hear this, I'm still open for that. I'm going to teach there if you're interested in that. And Daniela and I are going to do this together. But hey, all you have to do is get back to us. We want to help your artist to actually make a living from the practice that they love so they can continue doing that. If you just tell them how to brush the stroke and what art history is, that's fine. But they also need the marketing components.
Well, at least they need to understand what's out there, you know, how certain strategies work for them, others don't work. And, you know, probably we too, we speak probably a little different language because actually I studied at the Kunstakademie, but I think we mean the same. So I think it's about information that people at least know what is there. We had to get this all ourselves, you know, we had to find out ourselves with trial and error. And it could be easier. I don't think actually that there's a recipe to be a successful artist, or probably there's a recipe to sell your art, but it might not be great art then. But I think at least you need to have the information that there is a whole different world for you outside of the academy.
Yes, totally agree. My book, How to Become a Successful Artist, which was published 1.5 years ago, we sold, I think now maybe 50,000 copies in less than 2 years. It's a huge success because there isn't anything else out there that explains them how to do it. What my book and all my research is based on is not my personal experience. And here I'm very different to other artists or gallerists that might share their experience, what makes an artist successful. My approach to things, similar to my book, Management of Art Galleries, is always based on data. So mm-hmm. for the book, How to Become a Successful Artist, I looked at data of 500,000 artists and their price points, in order to find out what makes an artist successful, in the sense of why do some artists sell for $500,000 and other artists who do exactly the same sell for nothing. And the outcome of this is the book.
I think data is something very reliable, but probably I'm naive, but I still believe there is in the creating of art still something magic, you know, which you can't kind of like pin down with a recipe or with data. At least I hope it is like that. And I really believe it is like that, because otherwise for me, beside, okay, making money with it, but the point of art would be kind of lost if it wouldn't be there, that kind of magic, you know?
Well, I agree. It's magic, but it's highly subjective. There are no objective criteria that define what good art is. So it makes me always smile when people say, why is that in the museum? I could do that. Yes, you could. But there's so much that went into that work that brought this artist in the museum. And essentially, it could be the work. But as we found out in our paper, it's most likely the network that the artist was in that made the artist go that path into that museum. And there are tons of stories that can explain that. The magic of art is that it's so subjective. You might like something that I absolutely find ridiculous, and vice versa. So when I look at the artist that you're representing, luckily, I know that we have a lot in common. I know immediately that I would like a lot of the stuff that you're having in your gallery, simply because subjectively, we share maybe the same idea what great art is. But if I walk next door, I find a totally different gallery, and there I will think everything is terrible. But this gallery will also have their followers and fans.
And still, I think, for example, there are great artists whose work I really don't like, you know, where I think like, ooh, I'd never want to have that. But I still can see that those are really important artists. So I think there's a difference between my personal taste and between the acknowledgement that somebody really created something very important over time. And that is beyond my taste. There is a personal taste, that's true. I know that quality in art is a very hard to discuss, but still I think there is something which you could, where the term quality applies to, you know, so not everything which is painted on canvas is necessarily a great work of art.
Yeah. As I said, subjective. That's also usually the moment when I get myself out of the discussion, because I'm not an art historian, and all I can argue there is, hey,
me neither.
I like it and I don't like it. And I tell all my friends when they buy art, and as a disclaimer, I'm not an art advisor. So, but people come to me all the time and ask me what to buy. And I tell them, hey, it's very simple. If you like something and it's not expensive, you should go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we remove that fear of making something wrong and not knowing if it's good art or bad art, we can access a much larger customer group. Yesterday, for example, I went to the Whitney Biennial. I live right next to the Whitney. So it's funny that I didn't go, because today is the last day of the biennial, which is kind of a must in the art world to go and check it out. And then when I entered it, I read the description and I realized I really needed a dictionary. The description was 3 paragraphs and I had to Google 4 words in those 3 paragraphs. I think my English is okay, but the art world often makes it so difficult and so elitist and inaccessible. Instead of just saying, hey, we did the show and this was our idea behind it, they use all these fluffy words that nobody really gets. If we would make it more accessible, that also means that we need to be more sincere and authentic about it rather than pumping things up. I think this just turns people away.
Yeah, word. Last question. Why don't you have a course for galleries?
Yeah, I thought about it. Maybe I'm going to do that. Yeah. My book, Management of Art Galleries, which initially nobody wanted to publish. It's based on my PhD thesis. Nobody wanted to publish it. I got denied by every publisher, and then I had to pay a publisher the printing costs to have it published. And now it's a bestseller. We sold, I don't know how many copies. It's now in its 3rd or 4th edition and translated in different languages. It's the go-to book for everyone who wants to be active in the art world on the selling side. So yes, based on that success, I could do this. On the other hand, it would be a very short course, I think, because there would only be one sentence in it, and that would say, don't start a gallery.
You know, the thing is, I even would agree, because when I started the gallery, or I started the space as an artist and then it turned gallery, luckily, I just grew into it, you know, and didn't know what it implied. So I could really sort of like be in that open field and create my own vision of that without actually having studied business or having any business idea. Still, it became an all right, successful business. So the last question, yeah. Sorry, is generally, what's your outlook on the art world right now?
We are entering a difficult economic period. So the art world always lags a little bit behind, and then we'll feel it. There's always a time lag of only a couple of months, 5-6 months maybe, and then you feel it in sales. So for the next 16 months, it's going to be a little bit difficult. That means no big expenses should be done, no crazy shows where you need to put in a huge advance, not much traveling, no expensive art fairs where you might not see an immediate return. Art fairs are going to have a difficult time.
Mm.
And then it will recover just as the economy will. Call me, by the way, in 60 months and see if I was right. There is one other thing where I'm 100% certain about, and that is the impact that technology will finally have on the art world, and that is NFTs and the blockchain. We managed to talk for 50 minutes without mentioning NFTs and blockchain. So Daniela, congratulations for that. That's probably the first podcast I've done in a year where people didn't ask me about that. In a nutshell, I believe that NFTs have the potential to change the art market because, and I'm not talking about NFTs as the equals an expensive overpriced JPEG of some random digital artist we've never heard about. NFTs are nothing else than the certificate of authenticity. I believe that in the future, every artwork that leaves a studio of an artist, and here we talk about painting, so physical artworks, will have an NFT attached to it. Similar to today, it has the certificate of authenticity, which is on a piece of paper. It will be a digital version of that, registered on the blockchain. So whenever this painting is traded, the NFT will need to prove as authenticity, but also will be traded. So the artist benefits, because every time the NFT is traded, The artist makes royalties from that. It gives transparency to the overall market. It gives more money to the artist. It solves the entire question of, is it the real piece? Who is the true owner of it? And so on. Now, is that going to happen next year? No, it's not going to happen next year because the art world is super slow in adapting to anything new. However, it's going to happen the moment one artist with power, and here I'm talking about those guys, Jeff Koons and the likes, says, none of my artworks in the future can be sold if there is no NFT to it. And once this happens, once artists put up their force into the market and require dealers, gallerists, buyers, that only those artworks are real if they come with an NFT, then it will become industry standard. From there, we are maybe a few years apart, but this is going to change the entire market. And it's going to be so beneficial for galleries and for artists because new people are going to enter the market. Finally, the market is going to be transparent, liquid, and artists can finally benefit from resale royalties. So a great future ahead for us. And that technology is going to have a massive impact on our industry. Not tomorrow, though. I'm not a dreamer.
Magnus, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Daniela. And one last comment. If you'd like to reach out to me, contact me on Instagram or write me an email. I try to get back to every email that I get. It's magnus@magnusresch.com. And my Instagram is @magnusresch. And one, as you did, very last comment. I always love the name Van Horn Gallery. And it took me probably most of the time that the gallery existed to figure out where it's from. I was recently, only a few months ago, driving to Marfa.
Yes.
And then I drove to El Paso. Mm-hmm. And on the way there, on the sign,
you passed Van
on
Horn.
On the highway, I passed Van Horn. Yeah. And that's when I realized I know that name. It's from that gallery.
Yes.
And then I went on your website and realized that you named your gallery after that little village.
Exactly.
On the way between El Paso and Marfa. And that's a beautiful story. I'd like to end this podcast with Daniela. You're great. This podcast is fantastic. Thank you for having me.
Magnus, you're a great guest. Thank you for the compliments. Bye-bye.
Please find links and a text about my guest in the show notes. For more information on Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast, follow us on Instagram @VoicesOnArt and @Van_Horn_Düsseldorf. Visit our website van-horn.net and subscribe to Voices on Art on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the platform of your choice. Thank you for listening to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Stay tuned and connect.